This is Live from the Table, recorded at the world-famous Comedy Cellar, coming at you on Sirius XM 99, Raw Dog. And on the Laugh Button Podcast Network, this is Dan Natterman. I'm here with Noam Dorman, owner of the world-famous Comedy Cellar. We have Periel Aschenbrand here, the show's producer. Much put upon, but much appreciated in equal measure.
Thank you, Dan.
We also have TJ, Comedy Cellar regular, TJ from Haiti originally, now makes his home in New York City.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. And of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the maestro of the mixing board, the sorceress of sound, the diva of decibels from the great city of Binghamton, New York, or somewhere thereabouts. Nicole Lyons is with us from behind the scenes. She usually doesn't say much, but
Nicole, it's almost like he's flirting with you.
Yeah, that was a lot. That was like four or five different credits.
Hold on. Was that top of the dome or you planned that?
I planned.
Yeah, that was very.
Yeah,
impressive.
That was very poetic. Okay,
I might do it again at a future episode. We're waiting for a guest to come, but whilst we're waiting, I'm sure we have things to talk about. First of all, I've noticed Noam is dressed up today, and I inquired why, and he said he had an interview. So I'm a little curious about what the nature of that interview was.
Oh, the New York Times is doing somebody's doing a documentary about the entire Louis C.K. thing, but I believe it's from a pro Louis or anti cancel culture point of view. So I agreed to sit for the interview.
Okay. For a second, I was gonna be like, "Oh, we're not done with this." If it was on the other side of it, but even on the pro side, it seems like we should just let the guy live now. It's over.
Yeah, I agree, but it's always a predicament because if they're doing the documentary anyway, I mean, this is the calculation you have to make. It's like, well, what are they going to say if I'm not on it? Like, I want to.
Right. You want to stand for yourself.
Yeah. I don't want to.
Do you know if he's going to be on it?
I can say with a lot of certainty without knowing that he's not going to be on it.
Well, if it's pro Louis, then, you know.
Did hell freeze over? Because then maybe.
Well, yeah, he probably wouldn't do it anyway, even if it was pro Louis. But What is it going to be on streaming or where is it?
I don't know. It's just starting. Who knows even when it will come out?
Probably YouTube.
But it's not nice people making it. So happy to do it.
Well, more publicity for the Comedy Cellar, obviously.
Is it good publicity? I guess so. I don't know.
TJ, we were talking last time before our guest gets here about social media and comedy, TikTok, Instagram. Do you post things on Instagram and TikTok?
I do on Instagram a little bit, but it's a choice that is hard to make because for me, it's almost like when you do stand up, it's, I guess, to use a poor analogy, when you do stand up, you're making food in the kitchen, like a regular restaurant. But when you do social media clips, it's like fast food. You got to feed the beast every day and it's got to be quick. So the quality of the stuff you have to produce for social media is gonna be bad in general just because it's a quick turnaround. If you do it and you find that your followers rise, then you wanna do it every day. And nobody can write a great bit every day. That's just not how comedy works. So it sort of diminishes the value of stand-up comedy in a way, but it helps you with your marketing. So it's a choice you gotta choose.
A double-edged sword, if you will.
Yeah.
I think Attell could write a great bit every day.
He could. Nah. Can you imagine Attell? I don't know if that's true. He could write a good joke.
Attell should do a daily TikTok.
Yeah, Attell probably should do TikTok. Oh, and he probably, and it should be, I think, his crowd work. Because I think his crowd work is really where he shines the brightest.
It's unbelievable.
And it would always be new and fresh, and he wouldn't have to worry so much about burning material.
But he has so much old material he could put up there, too.
Yeah, he does.
He could also do that. Do you think, Noam, I mean, have you noticed that comics are changing their act to accommodate social media? A lot of comics, they don't want to burn material. Maybe they're doing more crowd work than they would have otherwise done. I don't know if you've noticed that.
Have you noticed that?
I haven't necessarily noticed, but I don't really necessarily watch other comics that closely. But
you notice that, Periel?
No, absolutely not. Comics are changing their acts to do...
Well, I wouldn't say changing their acts, but maybe doing more crowd work than they would have done otherwise. Because... they don't want to burn material on social media, but they want to get that crowd work nugget that might, you know, Eric Newman does crowd work anyway, but he was telling us that his most viral
clip was a crowd work clip.
Yeah, and that makes sense.
Yeah, he struck gold. It was someone who was somebody screwed his friend's mother or something. What was it?
Yeah, he was talking to somebody, and it was a girl and a guy, and the guy, and he thought they were a couple, but the guy had sex with her mom or something.
Yeah, but you're only going to strike gold if you mine for it.
That's right.
So so you have to be up there talking to the crowd. One thing I'll say from my act is, you know, I have a new joke about Pride Month. I probably wouldn't have come up with that joke if it weren't for the impetus to do topical material.
Oh, you're trying to record it to put it out?
I already put it up and it did okay. Whatever. Well, it didn't go viral. But the point is it pushed me to write a joke I might not have otherwise written.
So
true or false, Dave, crowd work is the key to the kingdom. Or TikTok. I don't know if it's the key to the kingdom. It's the key to not burning material and maybe the key to the kingdom.
Yeah. Well, if crowd work is one of the proven viable routes to TikTok fame, given the things he says, Ray Allen ought to have a few million followers on TikTok by now. Am I wrong, Dan?
Well, I mean, you have to use it.
He just started. He just started posting. So we'll.
Oh, he has.
He just started.
Oh, I didn't know.
I mean, literally, like when I started. So we'll see where it leads.
Yeah, I mean, crowd work is the purest form of comedy, so it makes sense that it works on TikTok.
Now, here's a question about crowd work. What if a person in the crowd objects to you putting them on TikTok?
That hasn't come up, and I don't think anybody is paying any attention to that. That could come up.
It will.
You don't really see the people.
You typically don't see.
Yeah, you only hear their voice.
You hear their voice. We generally
use subtitles to write whatever they say.
I mean, it's really, the camera's really on the comment.
The person would have to see it, would have to recognize their voice or remember the evening.
But you know,
and would have to complain. And that, all those things could happen, and they'd have a case. I guess you'd take it down. I mean, I don't know what they could do. What are they going to sue you? Because no one's making income directly from social media. The income
is there some sort of quiet agreement that if you come to a comedy show, then you're willing to be a participant in whatever happens
in the room, right? Not
in the room. I don't know that you're a willing participant on TikTok, but with potentially millions of people, literally millions of people seeing you.
Yeah, that's a good point.
If you find yourself
or hearing you in this,
if you find yourself a part of a viral comedy duo that's making a lot of money on social media, you might say, I want 50% of that revenue.
That's like, fair.
I'm your straight man.
Well, again, you don't make money directly on social. Well, sometimes you do, actually. Yes, sometimes you do. Sometimes you do. There is some sort of formula where people do make
money. Yeah, some people make money, but some people use it as an investment.
But most people are just trying to get followers.
But again, I've never seen anybody's face other than the comics in any of these.
Yeah, but I think legally, if it's your voice, you still have, I don't think.
You can have a case, I guess.
I think you can have some sort of a case.
I think so. Let's get Dershowitz on.
No one has complained thus far, but maybe somebody will at some
point. Yeah, people are greedy. I
sooner or later, somebody's going to put somebody Jewish on there, and they're going to complain.
It's worked well for a few people. Oh, okay. All right. This is just Jews? All right.
Periel knows, right? Essentially, somebody that Periel grew up with, one of these Long Island Yentas. Anyway, go ahead.
I still didn't grow up in Long Island.
Queens, the same thing.
It is so not the same thing. Like, it couldn't be less the same thing. And as like a New Yorker, you should know that better than anyone.
Dan, should you have a segment in the show where it's just Gnome and Periel fighting for 5 minutes?
Well, there is such a segment. It's not planned, but it happens
every show.
More or less. As I said, she's often put upon, but appreciated in equal measure.
Well, this is like bigotry in a way. Like, it reminds me of like for her, for somebody from Long Island, it's very, very different than Queens. It's like Queens, we're very, very different than Long Island, right? And they get mad about it. Like, I remember my wife's Puerto Rican, and I remember I had the nerve to suggest that it was pretty similar to being Dominican.
Yes.
And she's like, are you crazy?
Yes.
And then she began to tell me the things which distinguish the cultures. And the things she said were so, like, if I were to say them out loud, you would accuse me of being racist. She's like, they don't wear socks and things like crazy stuff.
Yeah, it's pure tribalism.
Yeah, pure tribalism.
It's insane.
You're the same as Long Island.
No, I'm not, because Long Island is the part. I mean,
it's not even a clear.
What you're saying to me, the implication that you're trying to relay is that. It's like this, like, sort of snotty, wealthy, spoiled Jewish.
Jappy.
Yeah. And and that's not true in Queens. Like, that's not true about where I grew up. And it's maybe true a little bit about how I grew up. But that's
rest my case.
No, I didn't grow up wealthy at all. I didn't grow up surrounded.
So are you like Rachel Dolezal? How did you get that? Where'd you get this long Alan Jaffe? How did you do it? It's amazing. You're a mimic.
I must have learned it.
I don't perceive Perriello's.
Well, it's Jaffe. I mean, it's Jaffe. Completely oh. inaccurate.
I don't perceive it that way. And by is that, any,
hold on.
In any way.
As the only non-Jew, it's that what
Jewish American princess yeah. is what.
And
it's like a very spoiled.
Give me a specific like famous example that I would know. Who's
you
the,
get
who's
like a
Jaffe?
Mercedes for your bat mitzvah and a nose job.
Yeah, usually those people don't wind job. Up. Okay. Usually you wouldn't know them because they don't wind up. Job?
they don't become public figures.
They don't wind up in show business.
You had a nose job.
No, I did not have a nose job.
It's apparent you didn't.
Hold on, I'm looking.
TJ's wearing a shirt. If I could just change the subject, saying Netflix is a joke. The festival, yeah. a festival that I was not participating in,
they
but
I was supposed to tell you about it.
Well, I saw it. I saw it on Facebook. Robbie yeah. Pra was posting about it. He's the Netflix comedy guru.
Yeah, comedy, yeah.
Who has about as much use for me as Michael Cox does at the Tonight Show. but in any case,
you've
welcome
never done
to
the
Grievance
Tonight
with
Show?
Dan Ackerman.
You've God, never that's... done the Tonight Show.
I did the Tonight Show with Conan years ago.
Gotcha. Okay.
He actually hosted the Tonight Show for about 6 months.
Because I can think of more perfect comedians for late night than you.
You know what cracks me up? I sometimes will bring up a story that I told like 5 years ago, like the time Dan called me out in front of this perfect 10 girl I was dating and he tried to totally sabotage me. He's like, we've covered this before.
We have.
And then he'll talk about the same thing 4 weeks in a row. Same.
Yeah, but I'm talking about shit.
perseverating 4 weeks in a row about the same.
I don't know. Perseverating a word? I guess it is.
I didn't mean to cut you off.
Whilst you look that up, I'm going to finish my conversation with TJ. No, Michael Cox gave me a categorical no when I sent him a video recently. Not a, oh, I like this joke and this joke, but maybe tighten up that joke. Not, right. Oh, maybe if you started stronger, but I like the, no, it was just a no. So yeah. I took it seriously. I took it personally. And I have mentioned it more than once on this show. Now I'm apparently as tired of hearing of it. Anyhow.
Well, I mean, talk about using the perfect word for the perfect situation. Perseverating, repeat or prolong an action, thought, or utterance after the stimulus that prompted it has ceased.
Perseverating.
Okay, look, it's from the word persevere.
Persevere. Oh, got it.
Okay, fair enough. It's a word. It's not a word that people use, but it's a word nonetheless.
In my circles.
So anyway, so that's what I was talking about with him. Right, TJ, that is late. I mean, maybe I may not be good at a whole lot, but late night talk shows do seem to be something I do well.
Yeah.
That my jokes are geared for, but for whatever reason, perhaps he wants new blood. I don't know what it is, but he has decided against.
Maybe he wants young, hot TikTok comedians.
Well, he may well might want that.
I've never done the Tonight Show either, so don't worry about it. I'm in the same boat.
But you did do Netflix is a joke, the festival. Look, when I was younger, I did a lot of shit too. And then I guess I
did premium blend. I never got to do that.
I did
that.
Do premium blend. But tell us, I guess, before our guest gets here, because he should be here soon, just briefly about the Netflix is a joke festival mm-hmm. and what your experience was with that.
It was a lot of fun. I was there. I was at a different venue, but the night that Dave Chappelle got attacked, I was doing a show very close to it, and it was kind of unbelievable because it was just comedians texting each other. Did you hear this thing just happened? And nobody knew what to make of it. We didn't know if it had to do with somebody being trans or if it was just somebody looking for attention or somebody was legit mentally ill. It was pretty crazy, but overall the festival was a lot of fun. It was I don't know if I should say this on the air. It was just like Netflix, the platform. It was too much. They did too many shows, too many stars, to the point where some shows were light. Or it's like, you shouldn't have light shows. You're Netflix. You're taking over.
Yes, that is very Netflix. I mean, I remember at Christmas, they had hundreds, I don't know about hundreds, but they had many, 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 many Christmas movies. And I tweeted that there was a miscommunication. Somebody misunderstood when the order came down to Netflix to make a Christmas movie for everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
And got like one like. But anyway, because I don't think people understood what I meant by it. I meant like for everyone, like everyone will enjoy it. But they thought it meant a different Christmas movie, literally for each person, because they had so many Christmas movies.
Yeah.
Did you get that, Nicole, when I said it originally?
Now, by the way, this is neither here nor there, but if I was in on the meeting where they decided on Netflix as a joke, for the name of the festival, Netflix is a joke.
Yeah.
I don't think I would have gone with it, although I have to admit, it seems to work in a sense. It sticks in your head.
Yeah, well, then that name came before the festival. I think they just decided that the comedy segment is going to be called Netflix is a joke. So they have an Instagram page where they promote all the specials.
Yeah, but Netflix so is I guess, a joke?
Yeah, just to say that they own jokes now. Comedy is them. They are comedy.
Netflix is jokes. Netflix isn't funny.
Listen, before Joe gets here, yeah, because I told TJ that we would do this, even though I'm not authorized to change subjects.
In extreme mm-hmm. cases, you have to make a petition before the committee.
I have exigent circumstances here.
TJ started a new show at the Cellar.
Yeah.
All right, that sounds like it's worth talking about.
Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm very excited about it. It's been really fun. We've had two
so far. TJ is a joke.
I got the third one in an hour or so.
What's it called?
It's called The Cellar Chronicles.
Okay, and how can people, and when is it? And
well, what is it?
Yeah.
Every other week. It's every other Wednesday. It's at the Fat Black Pussycat, and it's at 6:45 p.m. And the show is basically stand-up and talk show. Basically, I find a comedian that I like and I enjoy, and they do stand up and I do stand up, and then they meet me on stage and we sit down and we chat.
Did you ask Dan to do it?
Not yet.
Why you gotta make things awkward?
Dan is on my list. Yeah, we just do that and we sit on stage and we talk for 45 to an hour for the
Dan would be great for that.
The audience.
I think I would do well. And it might be, by the way, there might be some good clips that can be.
Yeah, yeah. That's sort of what I'm finding about it. The clips where we just talk and we riff and something funny comes up, then I could use that for social media without burning my material. So
but this thing that we did with Schultz and Shane Gillis and Glenn Lowry, I think.
Yeah.
Apparently clips of that have really gone viral.
I've had a couple of people reach out to me from that. Yeah, I didn't even know that the clips were doing well.
So that turned out to be a pretty good thing that we did.
Yeah, yeah.
And the clips all have the Comedy Cellar logo in them.
I don't know. I think we had Glenn Lowry's logo on it.
Yeah, I think it's from his the blogging heads, Stevie guys. Yeah,
I don't think you can see that. I don't care. But no, it was just nice. Like we did that show and nobody was really sure why we were doing it or what would come of it. But quite often when you do something like that, it's a good thing to do. And good things come to you from doing that are good.
Well, what things do you have lined up, Noam, that you think might fall into that category? Do you have any more debates anymore?
Oh, Glenn Lowry's going to do another podcast with John McWhorter and
in the VU.
We're doing some other things. We'll see.
Oh, great. When? Do you know when?
Lowry? Yeah.
Lowry and McWhorter.
End of June. I'll give you
cool. All right.
You keep saying you've been nonstop about how busy you are and how much you have on your plate and how you don't have time to do anything. What's going on?
Well, a lot of these things are not time consuming on my part.
A lot of them are not time consuming or are time.
They don't consume his time.
I'm not going to be doing the podcast. I mean, Glenn Lowry's doing it. The one I did with TJ was time consuming because I had to be on the panel, but in the future, I'm not going to be on the panel.
So why do you keep complaining about how busy you are and you don't have time to read any of my emails?
I'm not sure what you're saying right now has any sense at all. I have other things other than the Glenn Lowry podcast.
Asking you, what are those things?
Well, my family, I don't want to talk about them.
Okay.
Then does it feel like me and you or the children and mom and dad?
It feels that way every day, every week. Because I have different brothers and sisters each week. It happens to be you this week.
Just to piggyback off what you said, I agree with the philosophy of you do something because you think it's good, not because you hope it's going to go viral or people are going to like it or whatever.
Well, that's
it's
what I'm
first because you think it's
good. I'm, you know, they say you should go where the hockey puck is going, not where the hockey puck was. I'm going where it was. I'm like this social media. I'm two years too late.
I've never heard that saying. Is that a thing that people say?
I think so. I didn't make it up. I mean, I don't make up sports analogies as a general matter.
Yeah, that's not really the strength.
But that's not my strength. I'm like 2 years late to this social media thing. You know, it's probably too late. I mean, it's never too late, but you know, it is a little late in the day. Is this Mr. Lindsay?
Yeah.
Lindsley.
Yes.
Lindsley. I'm sorry.
That's a handful for sure.
Bring him in.
Lindsley. Okay, Joe Lindsley, are you there?
He's about
Give
to be.
Give Nicole a chance.
The sorceress of sound.
Was it devil of decibels?
The diva of decibels and the maestro of the mixing board. Joe Lindsley, how do you do?
Hi.
He's connected to his audio.
Let me just introduce you whilst you're doing that. Joe Lindsley is a traveler and a writer. was once a protege of Roger Ailes, who directed much of the national discourse, but then he escaped that frenzied realm where power mattered more than truth, as he puts it in his biography, and he began to discover the world. And now he is, of all places, in the Ukraine. He went to Ukraine before the war broke out. He stayed there. And I'm sure that's we're going to talk about that. Welcome, Joe Lindsley, to our podcast.
Hey, good morning, good evening to you all from Ukraine. And I guess, yeah, we planned to talk in March 2020. I think we had a podcast scheduled.
We did.
The week of when the lockdowns began in New York and over here in Europe. And so here we are 2 years later.
I know, it was so crazy because I remember you saying, well, I'd love to do it, but I'd really love to do it in person. I think you were in Germany, right?
I was, yeah, in Sweden. And then I flew from Sweden to, I don't remember. It feels like 100 years ago. And most of those years were since February 24th. But yeah. And then Peril, I've been following your post on Instagram of the work, you've been raising money with the Odessa Peace Fund, I think.
Yeah. And right? The Hummingbird Effort Foundation. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know. What is the Hummingbird Foundation?
The Hummingbird Effort Foundation is an organization that was started by my friend Dorota, who's a real estate investment banker, and she grew up under Soviet rule in Poland, and she still owned her family's house that she grew up in. And so she started rescuing women and their children. And as everybody knows, the men had to stay in Ukraine, and she started putting them in that house, and then that house filled up with moms and kids. And she started signing leases for other mothers and children and setting people up with jobs. And, you know, a lot of the people who she grew up with are still across the border in Poland. And she started this foundation. Now she's rescued over 75 moms and, wow. You know, over 100 kids. And, you know, it's a grandma who's now making pierogi and selling them, a florist, a psychologist. So it's, yeah, it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, well, it's, I say when 2 years ago when you invited me on, I was hoping to since you're comedians to tell you some of the more absurd stories of my my strange adventures with the chairman of Fox News, like starving at Chuck Norris's house and lots of crazy stuff. But now I don't know where. I mean, we do need to laugh, especially now in this and. But Mib, I'll leave it to you to direct what we talk about. But
I did want to find, you know, I have a big interest in Fox News and how it's changed and gotten worse and what kind of guy Roger Ailes was. These are the things I am interested in. But before we do talk about that stuff, what is your outlook for the future in Ukraine? How do you think the war will end? Will territory be permanently lost? What do you think is going to happen?
It's difficult. And I'd say I was in Lviv the first 3 months of the war. And that's where I'd been based for the past 2 years. And before the war, I was working with Ukrainian journalists. And the first hours of February 24th, with a bunch of volunteers, we created Ukrainian Freedom News, a Telegram channel, just to share what was happening here, to translate the news we could like unearth in Ukrainian into English, like really the raw stories. And then we realized, despite all this alleged, you know, aid money, soldiers were going to fight without proper gear. And these are things that you've seen as you've been raising money, Peril. And, people started to give us money that were reading our Telegram channel, just a little bit. And we would try to outfit anyone we could. And then I would say that the first month of the war, we had to deal with sort of Russian operatives in Lviv, because they were all over Ukraine. They were prepared to, they thought the country was going to fall very quickly, and they had operatives everywhere. And the second month, we had to kind of deal with the wildcat desperado foreigners that came to help. And finally, the third month, we have the competent people that are organized and trying to help here. And so only last week was the first time I left Lviv since it started. And I'm now in Dnipro. And then every day almost, I've been doing some day trips to the front lines. And it's a bleak picture. Yesterday, with some friends, we drove to a village called Gulliopoli, which is in one of the most contested areas. And while we were waiting at the last checkpoint for a military escort to get into the city, the Russians shot right at us. Fortunately, they were just far enough that they could not hit the checkpoint where we were, but it was maybe two fields away, less than a football field, was where the blast landed. And then the whole time we were in this village, our driver, fortunately, was an amazingly fast driver. We're going from hospital to a few other places to deliver some supplies. And they were shelling all around the city. And then after we left, I got pictures later that they really hit the city hard, which is what they've been doing every day. And because right now after their blitzkrieg failed of the first week of the war, they couldn't take Kyiv, for example. Now they're hitting little villages all up and down the south and the east, just because that's all they can do, to take this little territory at a time. And these are people that were living, I mean, as we were driving yesterday, I saw farmers still working in their fields. And, I pray that with that blast hit, that no one was standing in that field. And it's absolutely horrible. And the toll it takes on everyone. For example, at the hospital yesterday, I asked the chief doctor, and we're in the dark because we've given them a generator, but they have to save it for only extreme circumstances. And I asked the doctor, do you have any plans to evacuate? And he said, no, I must stay here until the end, whatever that means. And at that point, our translator, she was a very brave girl that came with us, she broke down in tears. And I think those tears, and everyone in the room got quiet and understood what those tears meant, that everyone here is at a breaking point. Because it's all dreams are on hold, everything is on hold.
Do you think Ukraine can prevail? Can they beat the Russians out of the Black Sea area? Can they?
Ukraine has done the Ukrainians have done amazing things. To keep this going, to keep the hopes of victory alive, and I think so, but only with support from the world. And unfortunately, people start to lose interest now, and I think that's part of Putin's strategy. But then there's different definitions of prevail, because let's say somehow you can push the Russians back to the borders of February 24th or to 2014, but people are broken. I mean, I was at a shelter here in Dnipro with children that have PTSD, 5 or 6 years old. So, there's all kinds of, you prevail, but, your city, like Mariupol, destroyed. Today, I took a walk with some new friends, a couple that's staying at this hotel where I am, and they're from Severodonetsk. And I asked the woman, I said, do you like Dnipro? She said, no, I miss my town. She said, we made so much progress the past 8 years since the Revolution of Dignity. We have beautiful parks. We had playgrounds for the children. We were building a lovely society. It's all gone. So even if you win, it's already a loss.
And tell me again, it went by me. Who are you there representing?
Just myself. Just yourself. I started in the pandemic. I started to work with Ukrainian journalists in Lviv. They had, it was so refreshing. They were so different from what I experienced on Avenue of the Americas, the News Corp. And so I was working with Ukrainian journalists, but just with my friends here, now in month 3 or 4, 100, whatever it is, people here call it February. Today is February 124th or something.
Wow.
It's still February. And we have some great American and British and other foreign volunteers that have come to help. So that and the team of Ukrainians, we work together.
So you're a brave man, actually. And that's an interesting thing all by itself. What motivates someone like you to risk your life in this situation?
I was just talking with some friends about this. I think part of it might be almost a small bit of, I wouldn't say it's like suicidal, but like a bit of like, this world is absurd. I think there might be that little bit of element in my mind. But I'd say the main thing is when I was here, when the pandemic began, there was a chance to take a flight to escape. And somehow I thought the little I knew of Ukraine at the time is that this was going to be a better country to be in the pandemic than most anywhere else. And the main thing is that no one was angry. People weren't arguing with each other like they did in America or other places. And Ukrainian society, I think Ukraine is one of the, even in this war, it's one of the freest countries in the world. People are free spirited and they're willing to die for that now. And I'm grateful for this country that welcomed me. And so I think the best to stay with them until victory. And there must be a reason why I got stuck here for 2 years. So it's bravery or not. I feel that I don't have a choice. And then sort of
TJ had a question, by the way.
Yeah.
What do you notice that people do over there, like right now, to entertain themselves? Is there any way to keep morale high? Like
TJ wants to know if they have TikTok, and if they do,
yeah,
they follow him.
Yes, and also, is it hard to get laid during a war? You know, those are the questions I want to know.
There were different phases of the war. I'd say the first month was everything stopped, and I was in Lviv is almost like a little bit like New Orleans in a way. There's always music in the streets. Even during the pandemic, there was, but the first month of the war, it was silent. I mean, it was like watching a World War II movie. Yeah, everything was scary and stopped. And when we really thought that Russian tanks would be coming down the streets in a few days. I mean, everyone, you know, and anyone that stayed there, we resolved in our minds to face, you know, imagine the Russians coming to your door. And that was a real reality. So that was the first month.
Let him finish his answer. Go ahead, sir.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I thought Lviv was supposed to be a green zone. Is that not?
It's become, so Lviv, I would say at the beginning of the war, no one knew what to expect. And the Russians had, they're very good with the psychological aspect of it. They struck all the airports around Ukraine. And so they crippled the air infrastructure. And so Lviv was hit, as was almost every other major city. And so... And no one, you know, I think the world thought that Russia was stronger than they really were. And so there was a sense, when it began, there was a sense that anything could happen. But then we realized, and the way the Ukrainians fought back that the first sort of 5 days, that this was not going to be so easy for Russia. And then things began to adjust. And I'd say probably at the end of the first month, life began to come back. I first heard someone singing the Bella Ciao song on the streets of Lviv, and then all of a sudden more and more music comes back and the bars opened a little bit, and life began to because people had to find a way to adapt.
I did see something on TV about a comedy show. I don't know if it was in Lviv or where was it, in another city, but I saw something about there is stand-up comedy there, and then they were doing a comedy show somewhere.
Is Zelensky getting back on stage?
I don't think Zelensky was performing that night, but
tell him he's passed at the Comedy Cellar anytime he wants to come.
Hey, you're welcome to come do a tour of at least of Western Ukraine. It is
how
pretty
funny
safe.
Zelensky came here and did a set, and Esty was like, "Nah."
No, Esty would never pass. Esty would never not pass Zelensky because he's Jewish.
That's fair. That's fair. All right.
I was supposed to go to Ukraine 2 years ago, and then the pandemic hit.
Well, that's when he.
But met. I was about to go to open for Louis C.K.
Really?
The pandemic hit, and I didn't go. And then Louis was about to go recently without me, to perform, and then the war came. So apparently, somebody doesn't want Louis going at the Ukraine.
I spent a number of days in Lviv, just about almost 10 years ago exactly, and it's a beautiful European city. I was also in Kiev, or now it's Kyiv, and it's impossible to imagine a city that looks like that. I know Lviv is not damaged, but Kiev might be, and in a war-torn World War II kind of way, we really thought that type of thing just didn't happen anymore. And it's just, I don't really have any point other than that. It's impossible to comprehend that they did this with no apparent reason. I mean, I understand that they have reasons from their point of view about, you know, essentially keeping Ukraine out of the Western orbit in one way or another. But to destroy the country and to murder people for that end is just, it's just impossible to comprehend, no?
Yeah, well, and I remember, I think it was 2 weeks before February 24th, Putin gave a speech, sort of his manifesto. And I was in a cafe in Lviv, a cafe Fatset, where kind of writers and philosophers and musicians hang out. And everyone was watching the speech. And at the end of that speech, no one said a word. And people just hugged each other. And I went to my friend's bar across the street. And the same thing, everyone just hugged each other. Because in that speech, Putin explained his hatred of the Ukrainian people. And I think it's because in 2014, they said, we don't want to be governed by your puppets. You know, they kicked out the corrupt Russian, pro-Russian regime. Yeah. And but when Putin gave that speech, everyone in the V felt, oh, he's coming for us. And it was a strange, I mean, everyone just looked each other in the eye and said, this guy is coming for us. And it was, almost like a crazy guy like Hitler. And say, I mean, like, he just hates these people and wants to destroy them. And I remember in peacetime walking through the streets of Lviv and like through the old Jewish quarter, and you can see the ruins of the synagogue and trying to imagine like the horror that happened there. And it was so hard to imagine in Lviv of, you know, of 2020 and 2021, the Lviv of, you know, but here it is.
Last question on Ukraine, maybe. What about the have you seen any Nazis there? So apparently, you know, Putin makes a lot of the Nazis. It seems to be quite pretextual, but not a total fabrication, right?
I mean, look, even if you read Wikipedia, you know, they say that, like, the Azov Battalion is neo-Nazi. And my friend's jazz club, which sadly just closed last week because of the war forever, 2 months ago, they had the first concert they had since the war began was a fundraiser. And it was a Jewish Carpathian folk sort of fusion band. And they were raising money for the Azov Battalion. And so this narrative that Azov is the neo-Nazi group, you know, that's not, you know, Jewish Ukrainians are supporting it. So even that part of the narrative doesn't work. And I think part of it is there's a Ukrainian toast. They say Slava Ukraini, Heroim Slava. And then they say Slava Nazi. I'm not even pronouncing it correctly, my bad Ukrainian. Nazi is glory to the nation. It's Ukrainian word for nation. Ukrainians don't, you know, it's English and Ukrainian are different languages. And I think probably some New York Times reporter heard that toast in a bar and said, oh, these people are Nazis. I think it might've been that simple. But no, I've seen a very tolerant country. And last summer, there was a jazz fest in Lviv, one of the few such festivals that could happen during those 2 years of the pandemic. And there were so many Black musicians from America that came there, including Adele's piano player. And he loved Ukraine so much, he stayed.
Adele's piano player?
Yeah, Eric Worth.
A Black guy?
Yeah, yeah, from Philadelphia.
His name Miles?
No, Eric Worthen, the second or the third. And he loved it so much. And then the night before the war, I was at that jazz club, and Ella Fitzgerald's son was singing. He lives in Ukraine. And he sang an amazing blues song that night because we all felt something wicked was coming. But this country is incredibly tolerant. And the Putin, you know, his narrative is ridiculous. But unfortunately, you know, one thing I could tell people is that this is actually an extremely tolerant and welcoming country. And we said President Zelensky's Jewish. I mean, it's a ridiculous narrative.
I think there's more to the. Listen, I'm not bashing Ukraine at all. I'm with you on all this. But I think there is more to the Nazi story than that. But I don't think, like I said, I think it's pretextual. Listen, these countries are complex.
Of course.
And there's residual aspects of recent history there. And I mean, Ukraine both has a Jewish president and was also one of the most vicious anti-Semitic countries at one time. And, you know, these are one generation removed from those people. So it was not going to shock me to find out there's still Jew haters there. Having said that, I still think that would be a very unfair way to characterize the country. Just like in America, we have our longstanding racist generations, and to characterize America simply by those people is utterly unfair. So, all right, Fox News. So, by the way, was your character represented in that HBO Roger Ailes? You were, right?
Yeah.
The actor looks a little bit like you.
Yeah, I drank beers with him, which is a weird. That was the first. I was the only person he's played that he had a drink with. But Emery Cohen was the actor.
TJ has to leave. He's doing a show downstairs.
Take it easy, TJ. So I
thanks.
I was Fox News was always considered quite conservative, right? And Fox News was always considered unreliable and blah, blah, blah. There were documentaries called Outfoxed, you know, more than 10 years ago with O'Reilly. However, at that time, this was around the time that you were involved with Fox News, I found Fox News quite good. Not that I didn't know that they were conservative and not that I didn't understand what I was watching, but I felt Fox News presented a pretty good debate. You know, these shows would have credible people from different points of view. I thought O'Reilly's show was interesting, notwithstanding the fact that he was kind of a blowhard. Charles Krauthammer was on Fox News, Fred Barnes and Morton Kondracki. There were a lot of interesting people on Fox News. And now it's, to me, utterly unwatchable. I mean, it's not as unwatchable, but it has a lot to feel guilty about. It spreads anti-vaccine. Obviously false anti-vaccine information dressed up in innuendo. It was insufficiently factual about this election fraud stuff. And I'm talking a lot. And I attributed in my mind to the fact that warts and all, and this is where you're going to tell me I'm wrong, or tell me where I'm wrong, that no matter what he was in certain regards, that Roger Ailes valued a good debate. That was the feeling I always got about Fox News, that Roger Ailes liked to see a debate that was fair and have good people on both sides of the debate. And now Fox News couldn't care less about that. What do you think about all? That's my impression as a viewer. Tell me where I'm wrong or I'm right.
There's a lot of truth to that. I would say, and this hasn't been explored enough, but I think Roger's downfall, the moment where his downfall began was there was a Republican primary debate where Trump criticized Megyn Kelly. He said something very awful about Megyn Kelly. Maybe you remember.
Blood everywhere, as if she was having her period. Yeah,
exactly. And Roger, I think it was the next morning, defended Megyn Kelly and came out against Trump. And and I wasn't there at the time, but I was just observing from the sidelines. He was already skeptical of Trump at that point. And there was a power play then between them. And Trump won that. And that's when Roger lost his power. And I think that there's more to the story there about his downfall. It's not so simple with Gretchen Carlson and all that.
How did Trump win it?
So Roger publicly challenged Trump and said, you need to apologize to Megyn Kelly. And Trump said, no, I won't. And that was when the balance shifted. All of a sudden, Trump said, I am now the decider. Because I think Roger's great power up until then as vis-a-vis a Republican was he could prevent people from becoming president, more so than even making someone the candidate or a nominee. He could prevent people. And he tried to prevent Trump at that point, and he publicly challenged Trump. And Trump said, sorry, no, you're wrong. And that's when Fox began to lose its power, I think, with the Republican base, and people shifted toward Trump. And then it was a few months later that Roger was forced.
Did we lose the sound? We lost your sound.
No sound, Joe.
Oh, sorry.
Roger Ailes came back from the dead to squelch you.
Yeah, hey, maybe so. It's I've been Roger's only friend, probably, and confidant. But I left because he wanted me to become just like him and to have I was losing my moral compass completely. And
what way? Tell us what way were you losing moral compass?
Because they wear you down. And they so Roger always wanted my moral approval for all the decisions he made at Fox. And but he wanted my moral approval while changing my definition of what was right and wrong. And part of this way, it was a weird thing. I was his protege, but I also, like Monday through Wednesday, I edited two small newspapers in the Hudson Valley that he owned. And so at that level, I got to see how he didn't know what journalism was. And he would try to get me to manipulate the news just because of his personal whims, he and his wife in the Hudson Valley, and who their enemies were, and to always be attacking people.
In the HBO show, they cover that, yeah.
They cover that, yeah. I couldn't finish watching that show, by the way, when there was this a scene where Russell Crowe playing Roger is talking to Emery playing me about my childhood. And I said, this is too weird. And that was the last bit I watched of the show. And unfortunately, they because it took Russell Crowe so long to get in the fat suit every day, they all the makeup, they had to cut a bunch of episodes. So they cut my car chase escape, which is the only thing I really wanted to be on screen, was my, I thought, pretty amazing car chase escape from News Corp Security. But that didn't make it into the show. News Corp Security. Part of it was Roger was afraid when I said I wanted to quit. He said, "You can't go," because I thought I knew too much. And they were weirdly attached and focused on me. And he was afraid maybe that I would somehow, I don't know.
So I don't put you on a spot, but can you give us a good, like, give us a good illustration of like the amoral aspect of Fox at that time? Something they reported that just wasn't true, or, you know?
This was in the days when Glenn Beck was working at Fox, for example, and Beck was reporting pretty heavy, you know, going after the White House, pretty strong, Obama White House, pretty strongly. And this isn't fit into the universe of simple boxes in American political thinking, but Roger made a deal with the Obama White House on their news coverage. And that was one of the big arguments I had with him. I said, "This is not journalism if you're agreeing not to cover things."
They made a pro-Obama deal.
Yeah. David Axelrod came to meet with Roger at Fox News. It was the only meeting that I was pulled out of. And afterward, I went to Roger and said, why did you exclude me from that? Not long after that, he got rid of Glenn Beck, who, I mean, Glenn Beck can be, you know, a wild card, but he would actually do his homework more so than a lot of the other people at Fox. And Catherine Harris was a great reporter too. But Beck would, you know, try to do his homework, and he was looking into too many things. And that was the same problem that when I was editing my newspaper, owned by Roger, in the Hudson Valley, I was investigating a Republican state senator who had dirt on everyone, including people in Congress, people in Albany and New York. And that's how he had been in power for decades. And Roger had wanted me to investigate this guy. And I did. And then I really started to uncover stuff. And then that's when Roger stopped me. And then I realized that he didn't care. Well, actually, I think Roger was the most fearful person I've ever met in my life. He was afraid of everything. And that's why he had to build up this power apparatus. But he stopped me from investigating that local politician. Yep.
Oh, so this is interesting. So, because most people and I were probably perceiving that you thought Roger Ailes was dishonest from a right-wing point of view, but actually you're saying that he felt repelled from Glenn Beck, who was actually to the right of... So Glenn Beck, I remember, got in trouble for saying something with racial overtones about Obama, called Obama a racist or something like that. And he got in trouble for that. And I think he had to apologize even. And in retrospect, that's nothing compared to the stuff that Tucker Carlson says every night right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And Tucker, by the way, is a huge promoter of Russia in this time, this is a side note, but they were just and Tucker appeared by a video link. They were at a conference in Budapest 2 or 3 weeks ago, all these American conservatives with Putin's only ally pretty much in the world. And Tucker speaks without without any facts. And at least for banks,
there's no bioweapons labs in Ukraine owned by Hunter Biden. That's not true.
I'm calling you from one right now. And that's the other thing is and this is in the ridiculousness of American discourse, but Tucker does, and they don't take the time to investigate things, but Hunter Biden worked with a Ukrainian energy firm, but that firm was run by a member of the government of Yanukovych, which was evicted by the people of Ukraine in 2014. So it's not Ukrainian company. It's a pro-Russian company that whose CEO is based in Moscow. And it's so strange that, you know, Paul Manafort, Trump's, you know, was his campaign director for a while, worked with Yanukovych people. So the people that Ukrainians said, we want you to get out of our country, Trump's guy worked with them, and Biden's son worked with the same people. Yeah. These are the people that Ukrainians said, please leave in 2014.
So what you're saying actually lines up with what my impression was, that I'd say that Roger Ailes was motivated, you know, he had a conservative agenda, but he was enthralled with ideas. He had a conservative agenda because he believed that conservatism was demonstrably correct and was ready to have that debate and thought he could prevail on the facts of that debate. And he wanted to show America that. And I would even say that he understood that the way you convince people is by defeating formidable debate adversaries, not by just having shills. And it seems to me the current Fox News, whoever runs it, the Murdochs, whatever, they couldn't care less about ideas. It's purely ratings and money. I don't imagine Roger Ailes embracing anti-vax sentiment the way Fox did. I hope that he wouldn't have. I don't know how you feel about that, but I feel like he was way, way straighter. And I understand he was a creepy guy and what he did to women and all that's all another matter. And I wouldn't lift a finger to defend him on any of that. But just as a viewer, I mean, I just can't express how awful Fox is and how much better I thought it was when Roger Ailes ran it.
Well, that's part of it. It's not, you know, in my darker moments, I've had regrets, you know, if I had just stuck with it. But, there were times when Roger would try to confide in me his regrets and how he wanted to do things in a different way, maybe. But I was so much like him that I was unable to be a friend to him in those moments. I was 24, 25, but I was very, very much similar to him. And he would try to say, hey, Joe, I think I made some mistakes here. And I say, oh, no, this is a weird conversation. Everything's great. And I sort of.
You remember any of the mistakes you thought he made? Or he thought he.
My mistake was that I didn't let those conversations happen. He would try to confide these or start to talk about these things. And I was so much like him, maybe even worse, that I didn't know how to be a friend to him. Whereas now everything I've learned and the stuff that's happened since I escaped, you know, if I was then who I am now, it would have been different, but I needed to transform myself. And that's been the process of this past decade.
What network should one watch? What news network do you watch?
Nothing. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if it's a healthy format. I think that's why I'm podcasts like yours are better. I mean, when people can actually have a conversation, the democracy is not possible without conversation. I don't think the cable. I don't think it's good for us.
They're all terrible. I'm hopeful that this guy Zaslav, is that his name, who's taking over CNN, who I know I've heard from like 2 degrees or 1 degree of separation of a friend of his, is a serious guy. I'm hoping that they will do something with CNN to make it something that smart people who are not extremely partisan will be interested to watch to get the bottom of things. I don't know, Dan. What news would you watch, Dan?
What news? I don't watch the news.
You don't watch the news?
No, not really. I go on Twitter and see what people are saying.
Oh, that's a good reliable
source. Well, then click articles from that.
It's better than Periel. She gets it from memes. She gets it from. All right, sir. Well, that's about it. I really appreciate you taking the time. I'm very moved by your personal bravery.
Are you still paying bills over there in America?
No, I've checked out from America these past 2 years, and I don't know. I'll return after victory for Ukraine. But
do you have any residents in America that you have to pay like rent to, or
more? No, I got rid of. I just started shedding all these things these past 2 years, and nope. In fact, I let my brother borrow my car, and I think he might have lost it. I haven't even seen photographic evidence of it in a while, so.
Never losing a car, but
sooner or later you'll get back to the States. You'll come back to New York. We'd love to host you at the Comedy Cellar one night, and you can tell the real stories. You know, the stuff too hot for podcasts. But God willing, be safe, and we'd love to meet you sometime in New York.
It'd be great. I would love to tell you, some of the entertaining stories, like the weekend at Chuck Norris's house with Roger and no food.
Well, go ahead. You want to tell it, or is that something you don't want to?
I could tell it if you want, but it's Chuck. Chuck invited Roger and his wife and their kid and me for a weekend because we were down visiting George and Barbara Bush, as it happens in Texas. Normal life in that world, and that's another story. But so we get to the Lone Wolf Ranch. This is very dangerous. I've told this story in bars to friends, but never, you know, it's very dangerous to talk about Chuck Norris, of course. And that's the thing. It's like going to meet Santa Claus, because like Chuck is a real guy, like I guess St. Nicholas was, but he's also a myth because of the Chuck Norris facts. And, so we get to his ranch. We have a nice conversation in his living room, which is covered with like pixelated pictures of Jesus and guns and bazookas and all kinds of stuff. And normally it's a nice custom when you're invited to someone's house, you know, they give you some snacks or something. And there was nothing. And Roger liked to eat. We all ate a lot. We actually ate breakfast burritos as our driver was bringing us to the ranch. But we sit there in the living room for 2 hours and no food. And then it's about 12:30, and Chuck's like, let's go fishing. And I'm thinking, oh yeah, Chuck Norris's house. You got to catch your lunch. That's what it is. So we go fishing, which is not a Roger Ailes pastime. And there was no one caught anything. And the next hours were pure delirium because we were so hungry. Because when we were on 6th Avenue at the News Corp building, we would have breakfast like in the car in the motorcade on the way to the building. The chef would come down. We'd have second breakfast. There's a secret Danish locker, which is another story. We just ate all the time. And that's also a commentary, I think, on our emptiness. But so ours at Chuck Norris's ranch, no food. We go horseback riding. And Roger couldn't get on the horse. Chuck couldn't because he's got two fake hips. The wives had no interest in riding the horse. So Roger's kid is like 12 years old at the time. He gets on a horse. I get on a horse. And Chuck says, this is so bizarre. Can't believe I'm telling this on air, but Mr. Norris says, whatever you do, don't say the name of the president of the United States to my horse. Okay, I wasn't going to do it, but now I definitely won't. And it was President Obama at the time. And so Roger's little kid, then like 10 or 12 years old, he gets on the horse and the first thing he says, Obama, and the horse goes nuts. Like it's trying to get rid of this little turd that's on the horse, and it could have said Obama. And all of a sudden, it was like that scene in Anchorman with a cat's flying over the bridge or something. The kid is flying through the air, and he lands. Chuck can't run after him because he's got two fake hips. I knew his weakness. And Roger can't run. The wives are just in their own, so I ran to make sure the kid was okay, and he was inches from hitting the metal railing. Fortunately he made it. And then more and more hours, like Chuck took me to a barn full of unsold Total Gems. And there's this weird delirium because it's now like 4 or 5 p.m. No food had been offered. We'd arrived at 10 in the morning, nothing. And at one point, maybe a couple hours later, Mrs. Ailes asked Mrs. Norris, like, are we going to eat? And she might as well have said, like, is there hamburger sunshine on Tuesday? Like, she didn't understand the question, like, about food. And And Mrs. Ailes got angry, and finally they said, okay, we'll get some barbecue. And great, food's on the way, but we're in the ranch in the middle of nowhere. So it takes an hour and a half, and this little bag of barbecue takeout shows up. And all of a sudden, all of these people show up, ranch hands, nannies, like all of a sudden there's tons of people at the kitchen table. We have to share this tiny snack. They pull out their Bibles and start talking about the apocalypse. And Roger and I are, you know, how far would you dare to roll your eyes in Chuck Norris's kitchen? And I'm looking at Roger and we're like, this is pretty weird, man. And then we watched, he's got a full movie theater. We watched The Blind Side, but no popcorn, unsweetened iced tea, but no popcorn. And then Chuck's like, okay, bedtime, everyone. And so I'm sleeping two rooms down from Chuck Norris. I can't sleep. I just hear the chime on the front porch of the ranch. And, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking of all the Chuck Norris jokes and facts about different ways to die. And so I get up quite early, like, I don't know, 6:30 or so. I creep downstairs. I'm sneaking around Chuck Norris's house. It's like, I would feel weird sneaking around, like, a distant aunt's house. You know, it was hilarious and scary at the same time. So I go downstairs. Roger and his wife are in the, like, the living room, and they look stricken because, you know, it was very dramatic for Roger. And he's like, he whispers to me, he's like, Chuck and Gina, they're still asleep. You go in the kitchen, look for some food. We'll keep watch. And he promised me that he would keep watch. And by the way, if anyone's listening, this is all just a Chuck Norris fact. It's just jokes. I'm making it up. Just shit. And so I go into the kitchen, and I guess it's like maybe 7:30 in the morning. And there are two kids are running around, probably scrambling for food because I don't know if they're allowed to eat either. And my heart's racing. Part of me is laughing. The other part is actually quite terrified. And now, because I haven't eaten, I've barely eaten in 24 hours, I'm a little bit delusional. Maybe this is like a security mechanism to, you know, to keep your guest weak if you're Chuck Norris. And so finally, I find a pantry. I open it up. And to me, at least, it seemed there are these clear plastic containers of cereal, but they all look even. And I'm like, great. If I take one flake of cashew, Chuck Norris is going to know because he's Chuck Norris. But I don't care. I'm so hungry. All we have is soy milk. Soy milk. At Fox News, you can't drink soy milk, of course, you know, for liberals. Whatever. I had to sacrifice. And I pull the bowl of cereal, and I put the spoon in. I'm so happy. I'm about to eat. And then I hear someone coming down the steps. I'm like, great. It's, I'm going to get roundhouse kicked, like, into, like, 1926 or something. And I'm ready to eat. And then I think it was worse than Chuck. It was his wife. She comes down into the kitchen and she stares at me like I had just like strangled their cat or something, which I was, Roger and I were talking like they got animals here. Can we kill something to eat it? She's staring at me and I just take a bite in defiance and she shakes her head with a complete and utter disgust. And she walks into the living room. And I'm like, great, she's going to grab one of the bazookas off the wall and blow my brains out because I ate a bowl of cereal. And but she just disappeared the rest of the day, and we sat in the living room talking about how Mike Huckabee would be the best and most perfect holy president of the world or something. God. And then our driver, who worked for the Bushes, finally showed up to rescue us, like at 5 o'clock in the evening. No food was offered the whole day. And she had all these like cupcakes and Sonic milkshakes, and I guess maybe she knew that they don't feed people. I don't know if it was fat camp. I don't know what it was, but it was weird. And so Roger was in such distress. He calls the pilot of the News Corp plane and says, send the flight attendant out to get like 15 Subway meatball sandwiches, which we ate in the flight home, which, you know, ruined all the effects of the fat camp. But that was a weird life.
That is a crazy story. That's nuts.
Have you heard from Chuck Norris since?
No, but maybe once you publish this, I will.
We got it.
Well, his wife knows what you did because she was a witch. Maybe she didn't.
She was a
did you know, we could talk another time maybe, but did you know Charles Krauthammer?
I did, because I worked at the Weekly Standard. When you mentioned Fred Barnes, he was my first boss, Fred Barnes and Bill Kristol. So I knew him not very well, but a little bit. I would sometimes deliver manuscripts to his house when 2006. Yeah, but I never had a good conversation with him.
My impression of him is that he was a great man. Is that your impression as well?
Yeah, I would say so, especially from the people I knew who knew him well. Yeah, he had true gravitas, and I miss his words. He was, I think, all the stuff we're trying to navigate now. His mind, we need minds like that to navigate the mess we're in now.
It's a good illustration of how Fox has changed, because I would say that at the time he was active on Fox, right up until the time he got sick and Laura Ingraham came and all that came, he was basically considered the intellectual voice of Fox News. He was the most profoundly respected voice on Fox News. And now I don't even know if he could keep a spot on Fox News. He would probably have quit. All right. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, you're right. I think he would have. And they don't have a leader at Fox.
What's interesting, and it should be said that to the left, as it were, or people center and left, they don't distinguish. They see Fox as Fox. It was the same Fox with Charles Krauthammer and same Fox now. And that is profoundly untrue. There's all the whole cast of characters that Fox rode to success. I think the overwhelming majority would not be comfortable on the Fox that exists today. Anyway, it was really a pleasure to meet you. And like I said, I hope someday to meet you in person, and be safe. We're out of time. Thank you very, very much, sir. Good night.
Thank you. And thank you. And Peril, thank you for all the great work you're doing with Odessa Peace Fund and the Hummingbird Foundation.
Thank you.
I've met people who've benefited from that here. So.
Oh, wow. We'll talk more on Instagram. We'll finish our conversation. We have another fundraiser comedy show.
We do?
On June 13th.
At the Cellar?
No, not at the Cellar, but on June 13th, okay. Which is also another fundraiser for Ukraine.
Great. Thank you, Joe Lindley.
Lindsley.
Thank you.
Lindsley.
Don't Pobachina from Ukraine.
It's a tough
thank you.
Yakshamesh. All right, well, that was interesting.
And what do you have to say for yourself, Mr. Dorman?
What are you talking about? Why is there dead silence? It should just end.
Don't end. What you gave me so much shit when I walked in here. Like, do you want to, like, at least acknowledge your behavior or anything of that nature?
Does every female in my life have to talk to me this way?
Well, I mean, you know.
Well, you can always rely on Nicole to treat you with respect. I'll let the record show. I didn't remember who Joel Lindsley was. And because I said, Pearl, who's this guy? She goes, well, there's somebody you wanted on the show. I'm like, when did I want him on the show? She says, before COVID. I'm like, before COVID, that was years ago. Like, talk about expiring.
But
I couldn't remember he was the guy for.
But you
Foxes.
Were short with me, and you were not. Very but actually, nice in your this tone. Is. This and is, I did email. I,
talking
you.
To the mic, Jesus Christ!
I'm talking into the mic, and I did email you.
Yes, you did. My memory's bad, but
okay.
Anyway,
so
but
just
I am,
be like a little bit less, you know.
But no, Perio, please note that after a certain time, you need reauthorization. I think it's fair to say. I say after.
6 you know, months left.
Certainly after, you know, if no one wants something that's time sensitive.
Okay, but
you
I
should
made,
get reauthorization.
This is the pollster who said Trump was going to win. Like,
but I said that he would be super interesting.
But you didn't get reauthorization.
No, but that's not.
He turned out to be interesting.
Okay.
Well, look, as far as, look,
I don't understand is Ukraine, that this is actual bravery, this Ukraine thing. I mean.
But it's also a little nuts.
He said himself that he might be a little nuts.
Well, did I see a military jacket that he was wearing? Is he a military guy? Because some of those guys, they live for this shit.
Well, that's
you know,
what
and
I
they miss
said.
It. And
I said that I think, you know, he's got like a little of that like Michael Moynihan vibe, like that like adrenaline.
Well, Michael Moynihan is not. Listen, anybody who risks their lives, you got to respect. I shouldn't say that, but I respect him.
Yeah, he's great.
Well, I don't know how the folks on Raw Dog will whether they enjoyed it or not, but
I thought it was really
people are interested in Ukraine, and the Fox News thing is interesting too.
Fox News, I don't think was a little bit of a less interesting.
It's interesting to me.
No, it's interesting. It is interesting. It's wild. I mean, that.
I don't. I'm not going to ask Nicole, but
she's sleeping.
Yeah. So I guess we'll wrap it up. Okay, I was. There was one observation about the whole Fox News thing, which is interesting. Type of stories. It's what I said at the end. Is that to the Fox News haters, they see Fox as a continuous evil entity, and it shows how shallow they are, because actually, there's clearly two Fox Newses. There was the Fox News before Roger Ailes and the Fox News after Roger Ailes, and the two could not even coexist. The people who were the main voice on Fox News then hate the people who were the main voices now. Anyway, so, all right, that's it.
Podcast at ComedyCellar.com. You have comments, questions, suggestions. You want to hire the maestro of the mixing board for your own sound needs, you can also contact us through podcast at ComedyCellar.com. And keep an eye out for...
It's Fader Fraulein at the...
at the Comedy Cellar. We have debates. We have not just comedy. We have debates. We have discussions. We have live podcasts, all sorts of things. Podcast at ComedyCellar.com for all your comments and suggestions. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time.
Bye, everybody.
Da 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 da.